We will call the House Committee on Health and Human Services to order this Wednesday, April 6, 2005. We have a pretty full agenda today, and I guess I'll slow down. We have a pretty full agenda today, and we're really glad to have each and every one of you here this morning, and we look forward to your participation in the bills that you're here for. Because of the nature of our meeting today, I'm going to take some of these bills out of order so that we can do a little work first and move those along, and then we will not be rushed to hear the bills that the audience is here to observe. So with that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2500. Colleagues, you'll remember that this is the bill that we discussed in Eugene last week when we had the visit down there to the substance abuse treatment programs, and we had the public hearing on this measure with the alcohol and drug treatment providers. So I'll entertain a motion. I'd like to get this to the floor. I think we're ready to go with House Bill 2500. It does not have a subsequent referral. So may I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2500 be moved to the floor of the House of Representatives with a due pass amendment.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2500 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Pamela, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Jones?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Greenwood?
Aye.
Representative
Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Butler?
Aye.
Chair Balto?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2500, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Let me think for a second. Colleagues, this is just a housekeeping bill, so I'd entertain a motion for the consent calendar.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2500 be placed on the consent calendar of the House of Representatives.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves that House Bill 2500 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? House Bill 2500 is ordered placed on the consent calendar. We will close the work session on House Bill 2500. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 3230. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2991. Thank you. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2991 comes to us from Chief Sponsor Representative Comp. It requires the counties to offer a license for assistant animals or assistant animal trainees. Representative is here to speak to the bill.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Representative Comp, if you'd like to come forward, and will there be anybody else testifying?
Yes, there are several people testifying on the bill.
We'll grab the sign of sheet. So go ahead and introduce it for us, please.
Chairman Dalto, members of the committee, thank you for holding this hearing on House Bill 2991. For the record, I am State Representative Betty Comp, and I represent House District 22. I'm pleased to urge your support of a bill that requires a separate license for assistance animals for handicapped people. As the situation now stands, business owners and operators have no way to determine whether an animal is trained to assist people with disabilities. Frequently, people are denied access to public buildings and businesses because they have a service companion with them, typically a dog. Owners and operators justifiably want to protect their environment from damage by animals. They also want to ensure the safety of others who might be using their restrooms, service areas, and other facilities. This bill creates a means of identification to help people make appropriate decisions. Many handicapped people are turned away from businesses and events because Oregon has no universal animal license or identification tag. I urge you to support House Bill 2991 as a way to help those thousands of Oregonians who use the help of a service companion to enjoy the normal activities of everyday life.
Thank you, Representative Comp. Are there any questions from the panel? Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, just which agency will administer this, and what's the oversight for issuing the licenses?
The recommendation would be that it's the regular dog licensing agencies. I think you'll have testimony here that some of those are in counties and some are cities, and so that they would be participants in issuing the license once they see that the animal's been trained.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
President Butler, follow up.
Thank you. And if I have small towns which do not have any licensing agency or counties that have no licensing. In other words, dogs are dogs and they come and go without licenses. What's your anticipation there when someone from Gentura or Vail or a small town who has no licenses takes that dog to Portland as a service companion?
But Representative Butler, you ask a very good question, and the reality is there is a gentleman here that's going to testify, and that we need to work out some sort of a way to make sure that that is taken care of, and I did not do that in this bill, but it's point well taken.
Thank you, Representative Cox. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Colleagues, just a moment for housekeeping. Are we doing okay on the closed captioning? And are we talking too fast?
Oh,
we're okay.
Sorry.
Okay. No, I just wanted to make sure that we're accommodating everybody. Okay. Representative Comp, thanks very much for your comments.
Thank you for hearing this bill.
Sure. Next, I'd like to invite Beverly Wright forward. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
You could start by introducing yourself.
I'm Beverly Wright, and I'm working with the Service Companion Association, and we're kind of the fire behind all of this work. And Representative Butler, one of the ideas which we had developed is, since we already have a program through the DMV for licensing, you know, motor vehicles and the like, it carries the addresses and names of everyone in the state of Oregon, it makes most sense to what we're doing with the Service Companion Association to run these identification programs through the DMV, associating the person with the service animals, either state driver's license number or identification number, and coordinate that with their service companion. A photo ID of these small dogs through the DMV would show that particular dog being the service companion for that person, because there is some swapping that is occurring, which people will show. At this point, all that's required is a simple note from your physician, like this. It's just a prescription note. In the state of Oregon, a prescription note is a legal document. But service companions are not protected by the state or the federal government. Service animals are protected by the federal government. The difference is that a service animal is for seeing impaired, hearing impaired, physically challenged, no more, no less. These animals can, on command, show you exactly what they do for the person who is handicapped. Whereas a service companion is generally emotionally distressed or medically needy. The problem is that many doctors are writing up these notes in the state of Oregon, which is a legal document and must be respected. Unfortunately, these animals do not have proof that they are actually needed, that they are trained, or that they even have their shots or license. And so we have many companions versus service animals who are trained by a school, although not sanctioned or directed by the state. They are trained by a school. But the service companions are pets. Many of the companions are taken from the Humane Society, are taken from a friend. Someone's child wants a pet, but where they live says no pets allowed. So they run down to a physician or a counselor and say, give me a slip. I want a service companion. The doctor writes the note. They hand it off, and the people go back to the people that they're renting from and say, look, I have a note. You cannot keep me from having this animal on this property. It's inappropriate, because these are not trained animals. Service animals are trained. Service companions, there's no guidelines whatsoever. And I have witnessed these animals in public buildings that have been disastrous. I mean, right in West Salem, I was in the True Value, and I had Joseph with me, and this is going to sound just awful, but a man walked in with a dog, not on a leash, without a badge, and he barked at a small child, he pooped on the floor, and then he threatened the owners and the woman who has the small child in the store. When the owner said, remove that animal from the property, the man got very aggressive and started yelling, "This is a service animal and you cannot make me leave." I don't know, but to me that seemed that animal was not trained by any measure or even safe for the community. So by setting some guidelines, it protects the good works of the service animals that are out there, and it formulates a way to show that people who would like service companions are actually trained, that they are licensed, that they are a particular animal, that they're not just sort of running ragged because someone wants a pet. It protects the owners of businesses from lawsuits, from people coming in and having their child bitten by an animal who's obviously not trained. So there is a lot of thought behind it. The other note is, if we could have one ID patch that goes on the outside of the dog. Now, harnesses, you can tell what school the service animal graduated from by the patch on his back. There's not a set harness. Anyone can make a harness. But that's not a problem. But we need one patch that shows the state of Oregon says this animal has either been trained or is in the process of being trained. So it is okay to have it within the public, you know, building. That, like if you go into a Walmart store, they can look down and see that patch on the outside of the service animal and know that it has been trained, that it is licensed, that it has its shots, that it has been proven that it will behave in a public building without distressing anyone else. So, there, you know, state ID on the outside and one they can carry with them.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just a question, if I may, for Beverly. Are service animals uniformly on leash when they're not when they're out in public? Is there some method of providing that they stay on leash so that we can associate them with the owner directly?
Normally, yes, but I've seen a lot of people who go in with no leash. I mean, one woman's carrying around an 8-foot boa constrictor, and she says this is a service companion because she doesn't like to be in public. So how you leash a boa, I'd like to know. And the salmonella that comes out of an exotic like that, another woman is walking around that Minville with a goat. And I've never known a way to train a goat not to relieve itself in public. So, you see, there's these exotics that keep showing up, and it makes a mockery of the good work of the service companions, the shepherds and the labs who are out there doing appropriate work. Another gentleman trained a small horse. Small horses, you startle them enough, they're going to bolt, and they will drag you behind them. So there are exotics out there, which is why the federal government has eliminated it down to canine, seeing, hearing, physically disabled. That is all that is protected under the ADA for reasonable accommodation. All the rest they see as a bit of a joke, which is why when you have a medical assist animal who's actually been trained for diabetic work or epilepsy or there's people who have manic depression who they really have anxiety attacks and it's the only way to get them into a store and out. They actually do perform a service, but the federal government says, I want to see what this companion does now.
And Chair, follow up.
Representative Butler, follow up.
Thank you. So for the federal government has limited, for ADA purposes, the service animals to be canines. Have they set guidelines for the registration or the uniform identification of these canines in that process?
No. When I spoke with them about it, because there was a big argument over the ADA and people running in saying, I have reasonable accommodation, ADA Chapter 13, I'll pop you in the nose. And a lot of businesses are afraid of being sued. So when I spoke with them, he says, if you can get it on a state level, there are 6 states in America that actually have a state identification program. Only 6. He says, if you can get it on a state level and expand it across the U.S., then we can accept it in on the federal level. But it needs to begin on the state and develop a program that we can bring state to state to state. Because there needs to be some guidelines. And right now, there's not. And they can't just pass that.
Mr. Chair, question for committee staff.
Representative Butler, question
Thank you.
For committee staff.
Do we have any information about those 6 states with their uniform, at the state level, the uniform guidelines, any information that has been provided to us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in research, all six states have websites on there. I did not compare to see if all the guidelines were incorporated, but the six states are identified on the web with the Service Animal Association, and I certainly can check that detail for the committee.
It's some sort of a statewide association and registration program?
There, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is a National Association for Service Animals. They then identify the six states there, and some other links that they have. I did not review or analyze all six states for comparisons or differences, but there are states out there that have, you know, these programs in place. Excellent. If you would like that detailed information, I certainly can provide it to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that may help us scope in on exactly what it is that Representative Comp's bill might be able to provide for us in this process, too. As to, I'm not proud. It's just, however, other states have done it. If Oregon can copy it, and if it's been successful in other states, that may be how we could accomplish this.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Yeah, colleagues, I've been told that I need to acknowledge each member by name before we'll have you speak, or the staff, so that the caption system can capture who's speaking. So, just a piece of housekeeping. Okay, thank you very much. Beverly, did you have some concluding comments, or are you all set?
We have a web page, Service Companions, out there.
What's your website address?
It's www.servicecompanions.com, and all of the written work is right there, and we have shown the development of the program that we are discussing. So his picture's there too, so it's all good.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to know what Joseph does.
Epilepsy.
Representative Butler?
Yes. I'm sorry. Epilepsy. He's a seizure companion. He's able to detect a change in perspiration on my body, and it gives me a 20-minute warning before I have an epilepsy seizure.
That's wonderful.
So, yes.
Amazing.
Okay.
So, thank you.
Thank you very much, Beverly. We appreciate it.
I'm glad she didn't bring a boa constrictor, Mr. Chair.
At least not you.
Or a goat.
Okay, thank you, Representative Butler. We will now invite Mr. Gordon Fultz forward with the Association of Oregon Counties. Mr. Fultz here? Okay, he's not here, so we will move him down. Is Danielle Knight here? Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Danielle Knight, and I'm the current acting executive director of the Oregon Disabilities Commission, and I'm here today to provide testimony on behalf of that commission. The Oregon Disabilities Commission opposes House Bill 2991. The bill will violate federal law, the Americans with Disabilities Act. The ADA does not require service animals to have any form of special licenses, certificates, harness, jacket, lead, or any other identifying information. The reasoning behind this was to protect the right of privacy of people with disabilities. We believe the answer lies not in passing a law offering licenses for service animals, but in educating business owners about their rights and responsibilities under the ADA. We are further concerned that a business will become confused with a new law that says they have to allow any animal with a license onto their premises. The presumption will be that they can turn away an animal without this new license. The problem lies with the process. How will the businesses know that they must, under the ADA, allow the service animal onto their premises even if the owner shows no such license?
Danielle, I'm sorry. Can I ask you to slow down just a little bit?
Sure.
So we can get caught up with the
captioner.
Yes, thank
sure.
you.
If a service animal is being a threat to anyone or causing damage to the premises, the business owner has the right to ban the animal, but not the person who owns the animal, and still must serve the disabled person, allowing them to access the goods or the services provided in their business. House Bill 2991 will not solve the problems, it will create more. We believe disabled citizens could be turned away from a business if they choose not to get a license for their service animals. We believe that businesses may be misled and not understand that the licenses are not mandatory, and through this action open themselves up to unnecessary lawsuits. It is our understanding that the Department of Justice is reviewing that portions of the ADA and that changes are to be proposed. Under current federal law, there is no requirement that service animals be trained by specially certified trainers. It is our understanding that the Department of Justice will recommend a change in this area as well as others. We believe that federal law, not state legislation, is the appropriate means of establishing guidelines for service animals.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Danielle, did you have any sort of contact from the service companion folks on this bill ahead of time?
We did not.
Okay. All right. Are there any questions or comments from the panel? Representative Cameron.
Yes. Currently, maybe I'm trying to get my hands around what's really going on here. Does federal guidelines say that the only service animals that are allowed are canines?
No. The ADA basically says that a canine is allowed to be a service animal, but there are people in the state that use monkeys as their service animals because they, you know, they have an allergic reaction to canines. There's three examples on the East Coast that monkeys can be fully trained to be a service animal and have been in good use.
Follow up, Representative Cameron.
As a business owner, your comments are about confusion. If somebody walked into one of our restaurants with a monkey,
right?
I think we would panic. And if there was some way to say I'm legally able to have this monkey, I think it would be simpler to educate business owners on a certificate versus leaving it up to me to say, looking at this individual and saying, does this person have a disability that I wouldn't recognize by looking at him, knowing that there's a animal in their lap? I think that would be a real good way to educate people, is to have something that would be presented in those unique circumstances.
In comment to that, I think the issue around that is the fee that it would cost for a person to go out and train an animal to an extent that a school requires graduation, the fee that it would cost for the license, the certificate, the harness, the badge, everything that would go along with this process. I haven't heard of what this woman's process would be and what the fees involved would be, but the majority of the people that I work with on a daily basis who have disabilities are very low-income individuals. And the animals that their providers allow them to have under the ADA because of their disabilities, the majority of them are trained. And you do have the right, if the animal gets out of hand, to ask them to leave. And the majority of the time, they do leave. I haven't come across a case yet in Oregon to where a person has gone into a facility and the business owner has asked them to leave because the animal has barked or because the monkey climbed up the owner's back or, I don't know, whatever the situation is. Oregon doesn't have any monkeys in it currently. But they've always been happily able to accommodate the business owner. There has been a number of situations where business owners have contacted me on their rights, and I've advised them and educated them on what their rights are as a business owner under the ADA. Business owners have rights just as well as people with disabilities, and my organization is happy to accommodate either side of that with education.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much. Thanks, Danielle. Next, we'll invite Robert Pope forward. Is Robert Pope here? Thank you. Okay, all right. Did Gordon Fultz come back? No. Okay, well, some interesting issues raised by this bill. I think it needs work. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2991.
Just one question.
Representative Cameron.
Does anybody know if there's a trained beaver out there?
Thank you, Representative Cameron.
Everybody knows you can't train a beaver. However, we are going to send in a cross-dressed monkey as a dog into one of your stores.
Yeah. Okay. That's funny.
Vicious animals, everybody knows that.
Lovable.
Right.
Representative Tomei, are you ready on your Clean Air Act?
Yes.
Okay. Next, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2836. This is the bill to modify provisions of the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act by clarifying definitions and exceptions in Oregon law. And I will invite Representative Tomei to come forward and present this bill to us when she's ready. And we have two people signed up to testify in support of this bill.
Thank you, Chair Balto. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I am State Representative Carolyn Tomei for House District 41, representing the city of Milwaukee and parts of southeast Portland, and I'm going to slow down. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in favor of House Bill 2836, which makes technical clarifications to the 2001 legislation we passed, the Indoor Clean Air Act. It comes to you in response to recent enforcement issues raised by the Department of Human Services. I've included a letter with my testimony from the Department of Human Services to Courtney Dresser of the American Cancer Society detailing these issues. The bill addresses these concerns, and since that original letter, the Department of Human Services has done some further refinements, and you have before you the -1 amendments, changing a small detail. I want to share with you some particular personal experiences of why I think this bill is needed. Shortly after the current law was adopted in 2001, I went to the RAM, I think most of you have been there, a local restaurant pub just a few blocks from the Capitol. It was a beautiful afternoon, and so I decided to sit outside. In order to get to the outdoor tables, I had to walk through the main part of the restaurant. The bar in the RAM is in the middle of the restaurant, in an area with the floor lower than the rest of the place. There was no special ventilation, separate ventilation system, and the smoke from the smoking pit floated right up to where the diners were sitting. And there, sitting at a table right next to the smoking pit, was a family with young children, and right below there was a group of people smoking. So that the smoke wafted up from the table where there was smoking right up into the faces of these young children, forcing them to breathe in all that secondhand smoke. Well, I talked to the waiter, and I called for the manager because I'm a state representative, and we had just passed a bill to protect diners against secondhand smoke. But when I met with the manager, he informed me that bars were exempted. So the bar that was in the middle of the restaurant was exempted. They could smoke even though there was no barrier, there was no special ventilation system, and the smoke from the smoker sitting at the table next to the children who were sitting at the restaurant, they were exempted, so that smoke was definitely being breathed by the children at the next table. Later on that summer, I went to Shari's. This is not in my written testimony. I went to local Shari's in Milwaukee. And as I walked into Shari's, I'd been there many times before, and the smoking section was always off to the left. And, of course, we always went to the right to eat. As I went in that day, the person who was going to wait on us took us to the left. And I thought, well, isn't that nice? The legislature has done a wonderful thing. We've made this whole restaurant non-smoking. So my husband and I sat down, and we ordered, and we're getting our food, and I started to smell smoke. And I said, what's going on here? This is supposed to be a non-smoking restaurant. So again, I asked our waitress to call and the manager. And I said to the manager, I am a state representative representing the people here in Milwaukee, and we passed a law that there would be no smoking in restaurants. And she pointed to me that right in back of us was a little barrier about as high as the back of my head, and it said gaming and alcohol allowed, no children allowed. and this small little area right in back of me that had no ventilation system, that was no different, had no wall separating the smoking area from the non-smoking area. They were now serving alcohol, and they had some gaming machines, video machines, and they allowed smoking. So those were two examples that I had in a very short period that our legislation that we had passed, the Clean Air Act, was not providing for clean air in restaurants. And as another example, a constituent called to my attention something that's called a hookah bar in Gladstone. And I've included for you an article from the Oregonian that was on Monday's paper about hookah bars. And they're sort of the in thing. Well, if you know anything about Gladstone, Gladstone is not an in place. But Gladstone does indeed have a hookah bar. These are pizza parlor / restaurants catering to young people that sell flavored tobacco products in hookah pipes. Folks lounge around eating pizza, smoking hookah pipes. Minors are allowed in these establishments, as you will see when you look at this article on sort of the bottom of this page. Quotes a young guy, Kyle, who is 20 years old. On the next page at the top, it quotes a young guy, 18, of Tigard, who is in one of these places where they're serving food. They're also serving hookahs, and I assume they're serving other liquor. I'm not sure about that. But minors are allowed in these establishments, so it should not be exempt from the Clean Air Act by virtue of being a posted bar or tavern. They claim that they are a tobacco retail establishment, but the pizza bar, pizza parlor, restaurant atmosphere contradicts that, colleagues. This bill, House Bill 2836, spells out more specifically what it means to be a retail business primarily engaged in the sale of tobacco. Other people are here to testify on the other provisions of this legislation, and recent court cases highlight the need for greater penalties for violation of the Indoor Clean Air Act and the need for clarification of non-smoking regulations as it applies to business travel. Many of you know that I personally would like to expand our Indoor Clean Air Act to provide protection from secondhand smoke for all our workers, but I just want to assure you, colleagues, that this is not that bill. This bill only clarifies the existing statute to give the Department of Human Services the tools that it needs to adequately enforce existing law. College, I urge your support. Thank you. Any questions?
I have a question. Was pointed out to me that work sites vary, and one of the examples of a work site is an individual who's driving driving a car for work,
right,
in the course of work, or a truck or a big truck.
Right.
Whatever, and they're by themselves, and some of them smoke while they're by themselves when there's nobody around. But that's a work site, and so there was a question as to whether this bill had anticipated sort of work sites where there are just individuals who are smoking.
I think what it anticipates is a non-smoker traveling with a smoker being required to consume that secondhand smoke. So let's ask Department of Human Services, which I think is here, and other people if that would be covered.
All right, thank you. Representative Cameron.
Yeah, just you're saying that this is just a clarification, but when I look at line 29 on page 1, actually inserting the word enclosed.
Right.
Going back to your example of the RAM, which I don't go to because I don't want to be in a smoke place. Well, I've been there a couple of times. What would that mean to the situation at the RAM?
They would have to enclose, right. They would have to enclose the smoking area so that the smoke would stay there and it would not drift over to the non-smoking restaurant. The whole idea of of having a non-smoking restaurant where we can go ourselves because we don't want to be affected by the smoke and bring our children, is that you're going to be away from the smoking area, not just right next to it so that the smoke can drift over. So they would have to enclose an area that would have a different ventilation system so that the smoke would be taken out and the non-smokers would not have to smell that smoke.
Thank you. Okay. Thanks, Representative Tomei. Next, we'll invite Dr. Mel Cohn forward, the state epidemiologist. And Dr. Cohn, did you want to invite Laura up as well, or is she with you or with your office?
No.
Okay, never mind. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the state epidemiologist at the Department of Human Services. Chair Velto and members of the committee, thank you very much for giving me an opportunity to testify on this bill. What I'd like to do is, you all have a copy of my written testimony there, which covers most of the points that I'm going to make verbally as well. But, you know, we have been very concerned about tobacco. Tobacco continues to be the leading preventable cause of death and disability here in Oregon. About 18 Oregonians a day die from tobacco-related illnesses. I could tell you if this... Chair Dalto, Representative Tomei, yes, about 18 Oregonians a day die from tobacco-related illnesses. I can tell you that if this were a communicable disease, everyone would be going haywire, and I probably would not even be able to come down here and testify before you today. But this has sort of become part of the landscape in many ways and something that, for a variety of reasons, we just accept. In addition to the direct effects of smoking, secondhand smoke, okay. Secondhand smoke poses a very serious health hazard as well. We estimate that about 800 Oregonians a year die from secondhand smoke-related illnesses. And so this is a very, very serious health hazard. The passage of the Indoor Clean Air Act was a very important landmark in terms of addressing this hazard, and the provisions that are in this bill will go a long way towards applying that law in a way that really makes it stick. And now I'd like to just go through a couple of the specific issues that are outlined here. The first is the issue of the fine structure. The way the law is currently written, establishments can be fined up to $50 a day, $50 a day up to $1,000 a month maximum for violations of the law. I can tell you that this level of a fine is really, I think, makes a mockery of the enforcement of this act. We have heard anecdotally about places where there's a collection bowl on the bar for people to chip in to cover the $50 fine. This makes a mockery of this whole idea. What is proposed to fix this in this bill keeps that cap at $1,000 total. So it doesn't increase the total cap, but it increases the fine per incident to $500. So in other words, we could assess that fine twice in the course of a month if that was necessary. And I think that's an amount that people will take seriously and will lead to taking this law more seriously. I should add that we have been told by our Attorney General that each time we assess a fine, we must have witnessed a violation of the act. So I suppose we could go back 20 times in a month and assess a $50 fine 20 times. That obviously takes a great deal of state resources, which you all know better than I do, is very, very much we're really under the gun in terms of deploying state resources. So I think that would be a very wasteful way for us to proceed, and this is a much more effective way for us to do that. The second issue is this issue about the wording of the statute with regard to employees who must travel with other employees as a function of business. When that happens, if they're traveling together, sharing a hotel room, sharing a car, and so forth, that becomes a place where people can be exposed to secondhand smoke. And so the language in this bill addresses that issue as well. Representative Tomei has already spoken to the, very clearly to the hookah establishment issue, and I think this comes from ambiguity about what is a retail tobacco shop, and this bill would very clearly clarify that. I understand that there is an amendment under discussion to actually change the original language of the bill, which said that tobacco sales need to constitute about 85% of overall sales. The amendment would lower that to 80%. That change came about as a result of some work that we did, basically talking with some tobacco shop owners to try to get a realistic idea of really how much of their sales are tobacco. And based on those conversations, we feel this is a fair number that really speaks to the intent that the legislature had of exempting establishments where tobacco is sold. And then finally, the last point I make in my testimony is this issue about being in a vehicle where somebody is smoking, that it's required as part of their work duties. We get an enormous amount of complaints, and you know, we are not able to respond to those as the law is currently written. So this is an area where people have been complaining to us that they're exposed to secondhand smoke, and we basically have to tell them that there's nothing that we can do under the law the way it's currently written. So we're very supportive of this bill. I want to thank the Cancer Society and Representative Tomei for asking us for this, you know, giving us this opportunity to provide some fixes to really implement this law that I think very wisely the legislature passed. So thank you, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Cohn. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Cohn, you indicate that you received an enormous amount of number of complaints relative to tobacco use. I'm wondering, relative to line 26 to line 28, retail businesses primarily engaged in the sale of tobacco or tobacco products, have you had complaints from people going into tobacco stores that they don't like the smell of tobacco? Is that a problem? Have you had, amongst these enormous amounts and numbers of complaints, have there been complaints from tobacco stores?
Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, I can't answer that off the top of my head to give you a firm number, but my sense is that we have not received a large number of complaints from about tobacco stores. And incidentally, I should add that when we had conversations with the tobacco stores that led to this suggestion that rather than 85%, we go to 80%, I believe that the stores that we talked to said that they don't allow smoking on the premises anyway. So from that standpoint, there may be some stores that are tobacco stores that do allow smoking. They would be continue to be able to do that under the laws that's written.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would just propose that this may be an amendment in search of a problem. If the tobacco stores presently, tobacconists presently, don't allow tobacco, and I don't frequent those stores, but it's my understanding in discussing with them that they do not allow tobacco to be consumed on the premises. And the Revenue Committee, we had an opportunity to go to the actual one of the large tobacco wholesale houses in Portland, and no tobacco was consumed anywhere on the premises. And that's why, you know, I find it kind of unusual that we're going to further restrict the tobacconists where they already have preclusions against that. So I'm just very anxious about that whole concept of coming back and saying, you can't go into a tobacco store and complain about tobacco. You know, I'd be a complainant about tobacco, the use of tobacco. It just doesn't ring right for some reason.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Cohn, I'm assuming that this is to make it clear that the hookah bars would not be a tobacco store, so that, as it is now, that's sort of ambiguous, and so in the hookah bars, they can claim that they are a tobacco establishment and can allow smoking when, in reality, they are a pub, tavern, pizza bar that also has a hookah. So it's not to keep people from smoking inside a place that sells tobacco products. Am I correct in that?
Representative Dalto, Representative Tomei, yes, that's absolutely right. It's really to clear up that ambiguity. We understood the intent of the legislature to permit smoking in tobacco stores, and we just want to make sure that they really are tobacco stores and not some other kind of establishment that's sort of masquerading as that. And this would clear up that ambiguity so that we can enforce that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Greenlight.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Dr. Phil. Can you tell us, will this make the law more consistent with Clean Air Acts in other states that have them? Do most states currently have Clean Air Acts? And will this be moving towards greater state-to-state consistency?
Representative Dalto, Representative Greenlick. I think that we have seen, not only across states, but across the world, increases in this kind of legislation. You know, we've seen, for example, in Ireland, where the law is stricter than the law that we have. It doesn't have some of the exemptions that we have. New York City, another example, and many, many other places across the country. I don't see most of this as really making the law stricter so much as it is making the law easier to enforce.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Cameron.
Yes, thank you for your testimony. How many fines have you attempted to levy or levied, not dollars, but the number of fines since the act was passed?
Representative Dalto, Representative Cameron, I can't give you that number off the top of my head. It's been very, very low, if any. Compliance with the law in general has been very good, but I can tell you that this concern about the low level of the fine and the issues around enforcement have made us particularly nervous about applying the fine provision of the law, simply because, again, you know, if people are sort of thumbing their nose at the law, that makes it that much harder for us to do our job around this. And I think our experience has been that in most cases, with you know, some education of the establishments about what the law says, what the law covers, and so forth, folks have complied with the law.
Okay, so there, you feel that there is,
there
is compliance, but there are places where we should be leveling fines, but we're not?
Representative Dalto, Representative Cameron, I think that we would have more rapid compliance, perhaps that's the best way to put it, from folks if the fines and the threat of fines were more seriously perceived.
The other concern I have is there are some provisions that operations can, a business can apply for some exceptions to these rules in the law? Is there some provisions there?
Representative Dalto, Representative Cameron, yes, there are. There, you can have an exemption or an exception, I guess is the right word, to the provisions of the law, and that can be granted by the state public health officer. And in the rulemaking process, the process for doing this was set up, and that is available to businesses who feel they'd like to apply for that.
Have you granted any of those?
Representative Dalto, Representative Cameron, no, we have not. The number of requests we have gotten has been very small, but I think maybe two or three that I'm aware of. I'm not the person who actually makes that decision. It's the state public health officer. So I can get you that number firmly if you'd like, but off the top of my head, it's been a small number of applicants.
So there has been application, but none have been granted at this point in time.
Representative Dalto, Representative Cameron, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
I'd like that.
Thanks, Representative Cameron. And thanks, Dr. Cohen, very much. Laura Culberson. Laura here?
Yeah. Thank you.
page. A couple other people are on 230.
Okay.
I'm going to read it out.
Good morning, Chair Dalto, members of the committee. My name is Laura Culberson. I'm the executive director of the Tobacco Free Coalition of Oregon. Our coalition represents about 400 organizations, businesses, and individuals who are dedicated to reducing the toll and death and disease related to tobacco use. I'm also testifying today on behalf of the American Cancer Society, the American Lung Association, and the American Heart Association, all of whom fully support HB 2836. Aside from the Department of Human Services, which houses the hotline for complaints against the smoke-free workplace law, our organization probably receives the largest number of calls about inadequacies to the law. I will first say that the number one complaint that we receive is from workers who are exempted from the law's protections and who cannot understand why the lives of people who work in office buildings or the legislature or even manufacturing facilities are more important to protect from the effects of secondhand smoke than the lives of those who work in the bar and restaurant industries. While this bill does not address these exemptions, it is imperative for this committee to fully understand that while HB 2836 may clean up some of the loopholes of the law, it does not address the major chasms that continue to leave approximately 35,000 workers exposed to secondhand smoke. I thought it would be useful to provide the committee with a couple concrete examples of calls that we get. Some of them have already been illustrated by Representatives Tomei and by Dr. Cohn, so I won't reiterate those. However, I will say that when it comes to the bar, what we call the bar-restaurant combinations, the examples of places like the Ram or Sherry's restaurants where there's a bar in the center of the restaurant and smoke-free or smoke, secondhand smoke filters out everywhere else, the amendment for 2836 or the way that 2836 is written would actually need to be clarified in line 29 to read restaurants posted as off-limits to minors and enclosed areas of restaurants posted as off-limits to minors rather than or in order for that cleanup to actually work effectively. The other place that I would like to point out is, again, we have had complaints from people who have used vehicles as a function of their work. And I've submitted to the committee a testimony from a cab driver in Portland, which is a very good example of people who are exposed to secondhand smoke as a function of their work. The city of Portland has fixed this part of their ordinance, but again, it would be nice to extend that to all people who are exposed to secondhand smoke in their work vehicles across the state. I will also say, in response to one of the questions earlier, for people who use work vehicles but are alone in the vehicle and allowed to smoke, that we believe that this law should not allow smoking in work vehicles at any time, because it is entirely feasible for somebody to use a vehicle for example, 4 hours and be smoking in it, and then render the vehicle to another employee of the business who would have to step into a relatively smoke-filled vehicle and be exposed to secondhand smoke. It does take a significant amount of time for that smoke to filter out, and people with asthma problems or respiratory problems would be impacted by that.
Let me stop you there. What about the contractor that owns their own truck or has, you know, sort of sole responsibility over a work truck, or an interstate truck driver who is an owner-operator, owns their own truck, will be the only person operating that truck, situations like that?
You know, I would have to defer to the Department of Human Services for really examining that situation, but from our perspective and from some of the complications that DHS has had in enforcing the law, the more exemptions you try to carve out or the more difficult or different scenarios that you try to build into the law, the more difficult it is to ensure compliance and to enforce the law. So
you're saying that those individuals that I described shouldn't be able to drive, to smoke in their own trucks?
I'm suggesting that it's easier to enforce the law if the language of it is very cleanly written.
Okay.
I do.
But we'll throw them to the side for the sake of a clear law. Is that what you're saying?
I'm certainly not saying that we'll throw them to the side. What I had suggested is that you contact DHS and find out if there's a way to accommodate them. However, I also would urge the committee to consider writing this law very cleanly and clearly so that they don't continue to have the exemption and enforcement problems that they have had. Another area that we have received complaints is that from employees whose bosses are openly violating the law and who are hesitant to complain about it because they may work in a small office, and there's no provision in the current law to have a non-retaliation clause. And in fact, HB 2836 does not include this either, and I would recommend to the committee to review this and consider including a non-retaliation clause. We've had incidences where people were fearful of losing their jobs or of some sort of retaliation for complaining, and therefore they did not complain. They instead called us. And there's not very much that we can do except for come before you here today and ask for you to clarify that part of the law so that people cannot lose their jobs as a result of complaining for being exposed to secondhand smoke. Other than that, I believe that other people have already covered what I wanted to cover. The hookah bar situation is a very real situation in other parts of the country. I would say that this is a growing trend, and we have an opportunity to nip it in the bud, and the section that clarifies what a retail tobacco establishment is would effectively do that.
Why not nip it in the bud by choosing not to patronize that kind of establishment?
The hookah bars?
Sure. I don't even know what it is.
Well, Representative Dalto, a hookah bar is a place where there's a large smoking pipe, water-filled smoking pipe, and lounges. A lot of minors are allowed to enter into these establishments. They're billed as a pizza place or a pub. They sell tobacco like melon-flavored tobacco or Orange Crush, which are clearly intended for the young adult and underage teen population.
Are there underage people smoking? People who shouldn't legally be smoking under the age of 18?
In these establishments, it's entirely feasible that there are. I would say that these kinds of establishments probably have the same kinds of difficulty with carding as pubs do and bars and other retail tobacco shops that, you know, often do inadvertently sell tobacco to underage youth.
So are they incapable of identifying who can legally smoke and who can't?
Representative Dalto, I don't believe they're incapable of doing it. I do believe that it is difficult to do so and that these places cater and market to the underage population, which seems to be a contradiction of actually trying to enforce minors not smoking. So clarifying what is a actual retail tobacco shop would, in my estimation, go a long ways in making sure that that does not happen.
Additional comments or questions? Representative Bruin?
Well, I'm 100% non-smoking myself, but I used to smoke, and I have friends who do and have quit, and I just think that what I'm hearing here is some good intentions, but there's a lot of common sense that we can bring to this, too. For example, in a hookah bar, I have to admit I'd never seen anything like that on this side of the Atlantic. It's very common in the Middle East and in some parts of Southern Europe. But as far as some of the things that we've heard today, I agree with wanting to set, you know, in the restaurant business and separate. It doesn't make sense to have a piece in the middle of a big room where a smoke is enclosed. But people can choose to not patronize smoking places, smoking, and we were just talking about, Brett Butler and I were talking about, sometimes we'll just choose not to go. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. And as far as smoking in your vehicle, my husband and I have a contracting company, and we have our own vehicles, and if one of the workers uses the truck, he just says, don't smoke in my truck. I mean, it's that simple. And if the guys want to use their own trucks and they're smoking in their trucks and he's riding with them, they know he doesn't smoke, and they usually honor that and don't smoke when he's in the truck. So I really don't know that we have to have that in a law to force people. You know, that really gets down into when you're getting in your personal vehicles and truck drivers and cross-country truck driving and all that. If someone's in their rig and they say, you know, please don't smoke, you know, when I'm in the rig with you, most people are pretty good about that and won't, so.
Chair Adalto, Representative Boone, I have two things to say to that. One is somebody slipped me a note, and I'm not sure who actually, that this law does not affect self-employed or sole proprietorships, which would address some of your concerns with that. The second thing that I would say is that certainly people do have a choice in what kind of establishments they go to, but the workers do not, first of all. This is their livelihood, and in this economy, which is very difficult, and especially in rural places where jobs are scarce in the bar and restaurant industry, the workers do not just have a choice to pick up and get another job or go somewhere else.
Would you work in a workplace that you knew was going to be harmful to you?
I would hope, Representative Dalto, that I wouldn't have to make that choice. Just like we protect office workers from asbestos in the building, there's no reason that we shouldn't protect people from a known cancer-causing agent like secondhand smoke. And I think it's quite unfair that we force people to choose between their health and their livelihood.
I'm not going to argue with you about the point about forcing people to take a job or not take a job, but you know what? There are plenty of places in Salem that I can go to that I know that I can be in an alcohol environment without smoke, and guess what? I choose those because I don't like to smell like smoke when I come out. So I think that people need to be responsible in their own choices. Representative Cameron?
Yeah, Laura, thank you for your testimony today. So if this bill became law, I just want to make clear that if somebody was driving one of our company vehicles down I-5, or a trucker was driving down I-5, now the state police would have the authority to write them a ticket for smoking in a company vehicle, or the city police. Is that what I'm understanding? Or at least report that to DHS, who in turn would fine somebody, either the employee or the employer.
Chair Dalto, Representative Cameron, I would probably have to defer to the Department of Human Services to answer that. I know that the way the current Indoor Clean Air Act is set up is it's a complaint-driven law. There aren't police or smoking cops or anything like that who go and do sting operations, and I don't suspect that that would change for vehicles and that we would rope in the state police to actually enforce this. More than likely what would happen is that there would be a complaint generated either by somebody else who had to use the company-owned vehicle or by the owner or somebody else, but it would be complaint-driven. And so I would suspect, and perhaps DHS can confirm for me, that that would continue to happen for vehicles.
So it's a law. So it's a law, but it's only. So, for example, if I'm going 80 miles an hour on the freeway is a law, but I can be given a ticket for that, but we don't have to wait for somebody to complain. But this would be a law that would only, I'd only be fined if somebody complained. That's what we're trying
Chair
to
do. Chair Dalto, Representative Cameron, that's the way that the smoke-free workplace law is currently set up, is it's a complaint-driven law. That's correct.
We heard earlier testimony today that we're not fining people. We're not seeing violations, and we're not fining under the existing law. Is that pretty accurate on your, from your interpretation?
Chair Dalto, Representative Cameron, I do believe that there are fines being issued, but compliance is generally pretty good, and from what we heard from Dr. Cohn, the fines that are being issued are insufficient to actually compel people to comply with the law. And so we have these examples of people taking up collections to pay for the fines because they're so low. So there are fines being issued. They're just not having the impact in bringing people into compliance with the law.
Thank you.
Thanks. Representative Tomei, and then we'll wrap this up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Laura, you mentioned there are 35,000 workers exposed to secondhand smoke. Who would those workers be?
Chair Dalto, Representative Tomei, those are primarily workers in the bar and restaurant hospitality industry. The exemptions include bowling alleys and bingo halls as well, but the majority of those workers are restaurant workers and bar owners.
Follow up.
And workers.
Follow up. And proportionately male to female, do you think?
Representative Tomei, that's an excellent question, and I actually don't know.
Okay,
I can find
out.
Maybe
you can get that for us.
Certainly.
Great. And also maybe their salary range? That would be helpful, too.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks, Laura, for your presentation.
thank you.
We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2836 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2606. This is the bill to require the Department of Human Service to publish an annual report containing a list of employers with 25 or more employees who are receiving publicly funded or publicly subsidized health care. I'd like to invite Representative Schaffler forward to introduce his bill to us and say a few words. We're not going to go too long on this one. 15 minutes tops.
I'll be here for two. Let me out. Chair Dalto, committee, I'm Mike Schaffler, State Representative District 48, Happy Valley, Southeast Portland, and I'm here to report that I did know what a hookah was.
Hail, Representative.
Vigorously, I'm sure. Mr. Chair, this bill will require Department of Human Services to, as you said, to publish an annual report containing list of employers with 25 or more employees with publicly funded or publicly subsidized health care. We are struggling to try and pay and help to pay for those that need health care and can't afford it themselves. And we just have a bill in business labor, and it's about some folks want to lower the business registry fee from the new rate of $50 back down to $20, because small businesses complained that it's not going for the administrative cost of that fee. Much of it's going in the general fund, and they wanted some transparency. And I said, when we add some flexibility to our rigid land use system, start generating more hydropower, milling more lumber, building more industry, putting family wage jobs back on the ground here in Oregon, and getting our revenue system squared away that makes it so that we can gather enough money to pay for all these good essential services, health care, human services, safety, I'll gladly return to that. But the argument was transparency, and I think a lot of folks like transparency when it helps their cause, and some don't like it when it doesn't help their cause. But all I'm asking, all this bill asks, is that we find out who is benefiting from state-subsidized health care. I don't think anyone in this room has any problem providing health care to the poor, the vulnerable, the weak, the sick. I honestly believe everyone on this committee is dedicated to doing that. But you know what? If we are subsidizing, some really wealthy folks and their businesses, why can't they come and help pick up the tab? I honestly believe if they found out how much this would benefit there. We also talked about the benefits of the education and the health system and the public safety system to business here in Oregon, because small businesses benefit greatly from that. Matter of fact, if you don't have a healthy, well-educated society, you're not going to have a healthy economy or environment for that matter. Now, I'm going to let, there's some experts here that are going to give you a lot more information on pro and cons of this bill. I've heard ranges from $5 million, which I know we can't afford at this time, especially down to $8,000. I understand there's some other states that do this, and I'm going to let those folks speak to that, because once again, I'm not an expert on, I'm darn good with a shovel, but I'm here just to advocate to find out where our money's going. I think we're all very interested in that, who it's helping, who it's benefiting, and how we can use it in the most efficient and effective manner. Once again, I'll gladly try to answer any questions, but I try to leave the questions to the expert, the answers to the experts.
Thank you, Representative Schaffler. Let me just say, Representative Schaffler, I think what you're most trying to get at here is making sure that people have access to good quality health care, that people that are working should have health care. So I appreciate what you're trying to do to ensure that we can get health care to folks and get an idea of who needs to do a better job. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That would be the end result.
Yes, thank you very much, Representative Schaffler. I notice you're not wearing an Oregon State tie today.
Well, actually, we're Representative Bingley.
Chair,
I am wearing a Beavers. I had my orange and black one on, but the good representative from McMinnville, Representative Nelson, was testifying before us, and she complained about no one told her, so I offered her to give me my tie, and I did, and then Mr. Bill Perry generously shared one of his Beaver ties with me. So
That's not my tie. Let me go on.
Okay.
Representative Schaffler, I think this is a worthy endeavor, but I do want to point out something. It's that any employer that's offering health insurance is offering public subsidized health insurance, because health insurance is paid for with before tax dollars, and consequently as a tax expenditure, both the state of Oregon and the federal government are subsidizing that tax. Because we're employment-based, we forget that our health insurance is subsidized. So what you're talking about here, I mean, I think it might be useful if we're reporting on public subsidized health insurance, how much we're subsidizing employment-based health insurance as a tax expenditure for the state, as well as how much we're subsidizing it as a fiscal expenditure. And it would seem to me we might want to be talking about both of that, because somehow it seems much more politically acceptable to subsidize health insurance on the revenue expenditure side than it does on the fiscal expenditure side. And of course, the dollars that we subsidize are order of magnitudes greater for what we subsidize employment-based health insurance through our tax system than it is through our fiscal system. And it seems to me we might want to begin to look at both of those kind of expenditures, expenditures for FEOP and things like that, and our revenue expenditures subsidizing health care for us, which I think is a wonderful idea, incidentally.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, just for the record, Representative Greenlake has helped me tremendously in the health care area. He's been in his whole life, and I would defer to anything and any ideas and any opinions he or any of the good members have on how we can make something like this work or find out where our money's going and use it most efficiently and effectively and get health care out there to the broadest, largest number of people in order, hopefully someday everybody. So, and one more thing for the record, Mr. Chair. I'm afraid to come before this committee, or the education committee for that matter. I'm much more interested in building America, milling lumber, stuff like that. So I defer to your expertise.
Well, we appreciate you participating, and thank you. Representative Cameron.
Yeah, just thank you, Representative. Just one question. Would this body, legislative body, be at that on that list?
Well, I wouldn't know why not.
So every employee that is working for the state of Oregon and receives health insurance in their contract with the state of Oregon would be on this list?
That's a technical question that I'm going to have to get back to you on.
Not under Section 1. Section 1 has a specific definition of which programs.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Representative Schaffler.
Thank you.
Patty Wentz. Is Patty Wentz here?
And it's under a specific set of programs.
Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Chair Dalto, members of the committee, my name is Patty Wentz, and I am with the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I'm here today to speak on behalf of Oregon union members and taxpayers in favor of House Bill 2606. This bill would allow the state to gather and report information on workers who have a job but no health insurance. And just to clarify one question from Representative Cameron, it wouldn't be a list of employees, it would be a list of employers. A majority, 61% of Oregon's population, do receive health care on the job, and we applaud those employers who are doing the right thing and provide adequate and affordable health care coverage for their workers. But a very large percentage of Oregon's uninsured do have jobs. They are employed. This means that when they turn to public services or get treatment from a hospital or health care provider, we all pay the cost. We just don't know how much, and that's what House Bill 2606 is all about. It will allow us to finally know the burden of cost shifting that occurs when profitable private companies do not provide health care to their workers. This is particularly prevalent in the retail sector, where non-union employers pay wages low enough for people to qualify for public health care. We know from looking at other states that this is a widespread problem. Recently, the state of Connecticut reported that taxpayers cough up to $72 million annually to cover low-wage workers and their children. The employers at the top of the list were Walmart, Stop and Shop, supermarkets, and Dunkin' Donuts. In Iowa, it was more of the same. Hundreds of people are turning to the state because their employers are not providing the coverage that they need. So across the country, states are starting to gather information on which companies are letting the employer, the taxpayers pick up the tab for health care. In Georgia, for example, more than 10,000 children of Walmart employees were enrolled in the state public health insurance program for children. The company's failure to cover these children cost federal and state taxpayers an estimated $6.6 million. And in Washington, Walmart has the largest number of employees' children enrolled in Medicaid, according to a government examination of records in July 2002. There's no reason to think that Oregon taxpayers aren't carrying the burden for these corporations in the same way they are in other states. But we won't know exactly how much until we hold the companies accountable and keep track of how many of their employees are relying on the state and free care for health insurance. That's why the Oregon AFL-CIO asked for your support of House Bill 2606.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments from the panel? Seeing none, thanks very much. Appreciate you being here. Monty Burke with the Department of Human Services. Is Monty here? And just for the audience, as Monty's coming forward, this is most likely our last witness on this bill, and we will move to House Bill 3230 next, which is the bill covering the deaf and hard of hearing. So that'll be next. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Chair Dalton, member of the committee. My name is Monty Burke, and I'm a program manager with the Office of Prevention and Transitional Benefits in the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families. I'm here to oppose House Bill 2606. House Bill 2606 would require the department to publish an annual report containing a list of employers who have 25 or more employees receiving publicly funded or subsidized health care. Information to be included on that report would be employers with 25 or more employees who access state medical benefits, the address of those employers, number of their employees who access state medical assistance, if the employer offers employer-sponsored insurance to their employees, if the employer-sponsored insurance is available, what amount of the premium that is contributed by the employer, and the total cost to the Department of Human Services and the Insurance Pool Governing Board for the client's state medical assistance and also of their dependents. To provide the required information, the Department of Human Services would need to obtain the data directly from clients and create a database in which to compile the information. Mm-hmm. Additional information required by House Bill 2606 would need to be provided by the employer, requiring staff hours spent in research. Initial estimates of the cost required to accomplish this are over $5 million from the general fund for the 2005-07 biennium. This amount is not included in the governor's recommended budget, and for this reason, we're opposing House Bill 2606. We have contacted the Oregon Employment Department to see if a tape match using Social Security numbers could be made in order to identify the names of employers with 25 or more employees that have publicly funded or subsidized health care. Initial response was that it was very difficult for them, significant problems would exist, and that would prohibit them or make it difficult for them to work with us to compile that required information. They have committed to working with us to see if there's a way to provide that information, and we continue to work with them to see if there's a way to get that information should the bill pass. There is a representative from the Employment Department here to answer any questions if you have them, and I thank you for hearing my testimony on House Bill 2606, and I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, thanks very much, Monty. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Monty, just a quick question. We heard from the previous person who was testifying that several states, including Georgia, have already compiled this information. Have you checked with how they got this information and if it was costly as what you're proposing this would cost?
I'm not sure, but I can go back and get that information.
Great.
For you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, very briefly. I do just want to note on the record that your statement is that Employment Division could do this legally, but that it's a complication of the fact that we don't have data systems that
I'm not.
Chair Dalton, Representative Greenlee, I'm not sure if it's if that's the issue or if it's a difficulty issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Thanks, Monty. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2606. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3230. This is the bill that establishes an Office of Services to Deaf and Hard of Hearing in the Department of Human Services. And with that, I'd like to invite up Representative Steve March forward to introduce this bill to us. Colleagues, we have three pages of people wanting to testify on this bill. So I'm going to ask Representative March to give us a good and comprehensive introduction of what we're trying to do. And then I'm going to ask the audience, as I invite you up one by one, to limit your comments to no more than 2 minutes so that we can get through and accommodate everybody who wants to testify and also get to the last bill on our agenda that we haven't yet heard. So with that, good morning and welcome, Representative. Sorry to keep you waiting.
No problem. Thank you, Chair Dalto, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Steve March from House District 46 in the center of Portland. Representative John Lim and I introduced this bill to ensure that existing deaf and hard of hearing services and access are properly prioritized and work well within the state of Oregon. While there is other related legislation in the Senate, this bill's primary purpose is to separate the service functions of the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Access Program, also known as DHAP, from the advocacy functions of the Oregon Disabilities Commission. I want to also put on record that at this hearing that we're working with the Department of Human Services to make sure that the transition of the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Access Program is expeditious, highly efficient, and quite functional. In addition, I want to also put on record that we will be removing the reference to the 5 cents of the 35 cents telecommunications charge from this bill. So there will not be the additional funding in this bill at this time. DHAP is currently funded primarily through contracts with state agencies for services related to access to state programs. Those contracts and that funding will remain in place, and these functions must be carried out at least minimally to comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act. While more services for the deaf and hard of hearing are needed and referenced as part of this bill, this is not the place to fund those services. It's estimated that 10% of Oregon's population is deaf, late deaf, deaf-blind, or hard of hearing. And as our population grows, those numbers will increase. Compared to other states, particularly our neighbor to the north, Washington State, we have very limited services, and what we do have has been declining. And this decline is due largely to the DHAP program being housed within the Oregon Disabilities Commission. As you recall, last session, ODC was, with the other advocacy commissions, stripped of its general fund budget and allowed essentially to live off of the contracted funds for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing program. This was supposed to be a one-time thing, allowing ODC to survive 2003 and through 5, but come back with an alternative funding for the Disabilities Commission in 05-07. Unfortunately for all involved, the governor's budget did not provide alternative funding and didn't even provide general fund money for the important mission of ODC, and instead proposed continuing the untenable situation of funding ODC on the funds dedicated for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Access Program. This bill will allow the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Access Program to focus on their mission and the Disabilities Commission to focus on their advocacy role. and hopefully, in the budget process, get adequate funding for that mission without taking the funds away from the deaf and hard of hearing program. And that, in essence, is the kernel of this bill.
Okay.
Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative March. I don't see any questions, so thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right, we're just going to go in order here. Brant Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Just for the record, my name is Brant Wolf, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association. Our only objection to the bill was to the funding mechanism, and if that's been stripped out, then our concerns have been met, and we have no objections to the bill.
Okay, Mr. Wolf, could I ask you to visit with the proponent of this bill just to make sure that you have an agreement on that?
Absolutely. Great.
Thanks
Thank
very
you
much.
Much.
Is there George Scheller present?
Sheeler.
Sheeler. George Sheeler?
Oh, four Bob. And Robert Abbott.
Good morning, welcome. Good morning.
Okay, you're giving me 2 minutes, so I'm not going to read verbatimly from what I've asked for instance, but good morning, Chairman Delder and members of the Human Resources Committee. My name is George Sheeler, and I live in Albany, Oregon. I'm a chairman of the Legislative Committee for the Oregon Association for the Deaf, for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Access Program Advisory Board, and also a member of the Alliance for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing. Can You Hear Us Now campaign. I've been deaf since the age of 12. I attended the deaf school and Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C. I've also held many positions in various deaf organizations here in Oregon. I'm here to testify before you today in support of House Bill 3230. All of you probably know Helen Keller. She says deafness is a worse misfortune than blindness. But yet in this state, blindness gets more services than deafness does. Deafness itself is a communications disability. It's not a physical disability or a mental disability. It is a communications disability. Once you lose the ability to communicate, your life is completely changed. There's nothing in Oregon to help you confront those changes emotionally or otherwise. A little bit of a history on the Deaf and Hard Hearing Access Program. Representative March just mentioned some of it. I wanted to point out that when the program started, we had 3 offices, Portland, Eugene, and Salem. Today, we have just 1 office here in Salem, and at this time, it is staffed by only 1.5 persons, an interpreter coordinator and a half-time program manager. These people are being asked to do an almost impossible job and are headed for disaster unless something is not done to change this. As you also heard the last legislative session, all funds were taken away from commissions. So the Oregon Disability Commission turns around and goes to the Legislative Emergency Board and asks them for permission to use part of the DHAP program funding. We in the deaf community and hard of hearing weren't aware of this request and were kept in the dark until recently. So ODC starts using 76% of the DHIP funds, and this left almost nothing to run the DHIP program. At this point, the program manager retired and the trainer and other staff was let go due to lack of funds. So where does the DHIP program stand today, headed for a certain death? ODC is an advocacy group. DHIP is a service agency. ODC provides no direct service to any disability group in Oregon. DHIP provides, at this time, direct service to state agents only. We are proposing to move ODC and DHAP to Department of Human Service and to separate the two programs. Also, we're proposing that DHAP name be changed to Office for Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services. The reason for this name change is because DHIP name has been tarnished, and we want to start with a fresh name and image. The goals of the new ODHS will still be the same as the old DHIP, but we are asking also to expand the DHIP authorization to RFP contract out to set up 5 regional centers in Oregon. One amendment I would like to see to the bill is to add the advisory board to the program manager. We in the deaf and hard of hearing community are getting tired of normal hearing people running our programs and deciding what is best for us. We are the ones with the hearing loss. You are not. Therefore, we know what service support we need. Thank you. I will be glad to answer any questions you have.
Mr. Skiller, can you hear me? Okay.
No, I have to depend on an interpreter.
Okay.
You might think I'm not deaf, but I am.
No, I just want to check. Okay, I just wanted to ask you, if you could, to work with the proponent, Representative March, to work through your amendment request. I think that you'll find Representative March to be very friendly and accommodating. So hopefully you can do that.
I have been working with him for the last 2 years.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. T.J. Campbell. Is T.J. Campbell present? T.J. Campbell Carson?
Mm. Yes, sir.
Good morning, welcome.
Good morning. Let me adjust my papers here, just a second. Your Honor. Good morning, Chairman Dalto and members of the committee. It is my pleasure to be here and share with you. My name is T.J. Campbell Carson. I'm deaf, I'm a native Oregonian, and a taxpayer. English is my second language. American Sign Language is unspoken, unwritten. It's a visual language. I'll let you know that what I've typewritten and passed out to you is an example of my English with no one to correct my grammar. For your information, deaf people on average in America have a reading level of fourth grade. It doesn't mean they have bad English, but it just happens to be their second language. They use their eyes, not their ears, to listen or to be educated. Okay, I'm a deaf interpreter, and I volunteered to help clarify conversations between clients and interpreters, along with other professionals like doctors, counselors, and that sort of thing. I'm also a chemical dependency professional, trainee, under the state of Washington, which is the same title as a chemical dependency counselor for Oregon. But I recently resigned as a certified dependency professional in Washington. If you want to become a CDC in Washington State, you have to complete college plus approximately 3,000 hours of an internship. In Oregon, we only need 150 hours of internship and meet some other requirements. Well, guess what? Where I used to work at the Northwest Deaf Addiction Center, which is located in Vancouver, Washington, that's only one of 5 deaf treatment facilities for the deaf in the United States. One of 5. Even though they have a long waiting list for deaf addicts to be admitted for treatment in the facility. Oregon doesn't have a treatment facility, and we do need one badly. Unfortunately, I quit working at the Northwest Deaf Addiction Center because of the long commute and way too many hours on the road. That was approximately 500 miles a week for 3 years, 3.5 years. Right now, I'm residing locally here in Salem and focusing on helping my family and local people here that need lots of help in the areas of advocacy, counseling, you name it. I feel bad, and I don't want to do it without being certified or having the training. I have often referred people to the correct specific agencies. I spent many hours volunteering to help deaf people here locally, even in Portland and throughout the Willamette Valley. I have the greatest burden for the deaf community. It grieves me to see so many of them without help from us professionally.
Okay, excuse me. So, sorry to interrupt your progress. We have a lot of people
that's
to
fine.
Get to, and we have a floor session that's starting in about a half an hour.
That's fine.
And so I just wanted to ask you, if I could, to tell me why you feel we need House Bill 3230.
Let me refer. I have it written here.
Okay.
As I talked about English as a second language for deaf people, let's see, with your interruption, I'm a little thrown off course here.
Take your time.
Thank you. If I could complete my comments, I think it would cover what you're asking. For example, for deaf people on job applications or legal terminology, sometimes the vocabulary is not understandable to them. They need an advocate to explain the meanings for them to get through the paperwork. Lots of times they'll sign contracts without even knowing what they say. All the legalese that comes up, they need an advocate to help translate that sometimes. I have a strong belief that we should have many different options for deaf. For example, why would we have to drink one brand of orange juice? Why would that be? As a comparison, there are many different brands. We have Fred Meyer, we have Safeway, we have Bel Air, we have Five Alive, Flavor Pack. Just like choices of basic orange juice in America, why are deaf people forced to participate in just one choice? We need a range of choices that would be provided by these centers. And if what's provided already isn't of good quality, I'm just saying, why should we be forced to consume one type of option here? We do need the special service centers for the deaf and hard of hearing in Oregon. Trust me, you'd be surprised how much help and benefit that would be for the deaf community if you could provide these deaf and hard of hearing service centers. It would be an investment in deaf people's future for our future success.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. You did a great job, and we have your comments here. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, next I would like to invite Linda Roby forward. Is that Sister Linda Roby? Okay, thank you. Good morning, welcome.
Thank you very much, Chairman Dalto and members of the committee.
I'm sorry, if we could also ask you to try to keep your comments as brief as possible. I appreciate it. Thank you.
My name is Sister Linda Roby. I'm the Director of Catholic Deaf Ministry for the Archdiocese of Portland. And I come before you today in strong support of House Bill 3230. In my service with the Catholic Deaf community for the past 12 years, excuse me, I have become acutely aware of the lack of services that are available to individuals in our state who are deaf, deafblind, or hard of hearing. This is especially true when these people are experiencing times of transition or crisis. There is no designated place or program they can turn to in seeking the support, counseling, and guidance that they need in order to help them regain their stability. Oregon Service Centers for Deaf and Hard of Hearing would provide these much-needed services. Trying to negotiate one's way through agencies and systems is a huge challenge without appropriate information and sign language communication services. Furthermore, persons providing this support need to have strong understanding of deaf culture and the specific needs of this community. The past establishment of the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Access Program offered great hope to the members of this community, but has been a great disappointment in that it is understaffed and unable to serve the express needs that it was meant to serve. The change to deaf service centers would assure these Oregonians that their voices have been heard. The presenters of this bill know that the key to its success is collaboration with existing agencies and advocacy groups. They are asking that these service centers be established to provide them with the means of obtaining equal access to services that are available to all Oregonians. I encourage your committee to bring this bill to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation, and I thank you for your consideration and support of this important request and the people who present it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sister Roby. Just for a point of technical clarification, this bill has a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, and so the first step would be for us to pass this bill out of committee and then refer it to Ways and Means, since it does have a fiscal implication. So I just wanted to get that out.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your comments. We appreciate them. Next, I'd like to invite forward Margie Morgan. Is Margie Morgan here? Okay. Good morning, welcome.
Hello, and good morning. Chair Dalto and members of the committee, my name is Margie Morgan, and I'm Vice President of the Oregon Association of the Deaf and President of the Oregon Association of the Deaf Alumni Association. I've been deaf since birth. I've been involved in the deaf community for over 30 years in Roseburg, Portland, and Salem, and I've been serving deaf people in the community by supporting them and referring them to places which can meet their needs. But there are a few services available, and they're spread throughout Oregon. Many people cannot drive or do not have access to public transportation to take them where their services are. They prefer to talk directly to service providers who are fluent in ASL communication rather than use interpreting services. I want to share with you a situation I recently shared with a deaf woman. She has experienced a hard life and has been working hard to save income. In 1995, she was excited to be able to buy a house that she had been renting. The seller told her to sign the papers, even though she couldn't read the important notes that the landlord had written her. Her daughter, who was involved with drug use, was able to communicate with the different sign language this woman used, American Sign Language, Korean Sign Language, but the daughter could not explain to her completely what the seller told her. Last January, she showed me the mortgage and the property tax papers, and I notified her that the house still belonged to the seller. She had misunderstood the whole process and could easily have lost the house. A volunteer attorney helped her to process the papers properly. I think that with many deaf people who are not able to read clearly and understand the fine print of the papers they are required to sign, people can easily fool them or take advantage of them and cause them to get into trouble. Where are the services to protect them? And there are no places in Oregon for them to receive the advice and advocacy they need. The Oregon Association of the Deaf has tried to provide services in the past. Unfortunately, they had to close their services due to lack of money. Now is the time for the state of Oregon to provide deaf and hard of hearing Oregons the services they need. Please support House Bill 3230, which would provide places for services to deaf and hard of hearing individuals through the establishment of services centers in 5 locations in Oregon. And ASL is a different language than English, as you can see, and the interpreter was reading my presentation. If you have any questions.
Thank you very much, Marty.
Thank you for your time.
Nice job. Danielle Knight, are you still here? Welcome back.
Thank you, Chair Dalto and members of the committee. Instead of going through and reading this testimony, I'll just go ahead quickly.
And you like that.
I know. And quickly just state what the Oregon Disabilities Commission on this bill is. Currently, the commission does not oppose any service centers for the deaf and hard of hearing community. We certainly support all service centers and all services that this community needs. However, we do oppose the separation of the two programs. The Oregon Disabilities Commission, as I'm sure some of you are aware, has been in jeopardy the last couple of sessions due to funding or lack of. And we have been in dialogue because the governor's office has asked us to speak to the Department of Human Services to maintain sustainability within their department. We have that open dialogue, and it will continue. We're not established for Ways and Means at this point, so we don't really know where we're going to be. But we're hoping that with these two organizations, we'll be able to move into the Department of Human Services and provide all services to people with disabilities in Oregon, including the deaf and hard of hearing. And that includes the service centers they're requesting.
Okay. Thank you very much. Is there a Bob Williams present? Good morning, welcome.
Good morning. My name is Bob Williams. I live in Sublimity. And Mr. Chairman Dalto and members of the committee, thank you so much for allowing me to share with you. First of all, I want to say that my computer did not compute the title of this right, and so I had to revise that at the last moment. Also, I came to testify mostly on behalf of the 5-cent increase, and I understand that is no longer going to be on this bill. Nevertheless, there is much that I would like to share with you, and I'll try to be as brief as possible. First of all, I do want you to know that I am clinically deaf. I wear a cochlear implant, which was provided by the VA. I'm a disabled deaf, and that has brought back the hearing world to me in some marvelous ways, and that's largely why I'm here. I am a member of the board of directors for Self-Help for Hard of Hearing People of Oregon, and also do sit as a member of the DHAP Advisory Council. I have been on that council now for about 5.5 years, and during that time have seen the DHAP program go from one full-time program manager and trainer to a part-time program manager and a lady who takes care of the interpretive services. And so I come very much in support of Senate Bill 3230 and encourage a due pass on this in order to adequately provide. And of course, I represent the hard of hearing. You've heard a lot from the deaf culture. This is a very different issue. And there's also these centers would provide for real-time captioning and assistive listening technology, which is tremendously important. And I do want you to know that a couple of years ago that I moderated some panels around the state for DHAP to hear from the deaf and hard of hearing community. And in those panels we found that once you get outside the valley corridor, that there's just not much out there for anybody. And so these five centers would help us a great deal with that. And one other thing I want to say is that we have communicated a great deal with James Hayes of Department of Human Services, and I hope that this bill will pass and look forward to being able to work with him to separate advocacy and service. With that, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks very much for your testimony. Is David Beers here? David Beers, welcome. And if I could just take a moment to conduct some housekeeping. Colleagues, it appears that the floor session starts today at 10:45. The first order of business is a House joint memorial about Canadian geese. And then after that, very exciting, after that is the reconnect-disconnect bill, which has a committee and minority report on it. That's going to take a while, so my plan is to keep going personally here, but I understand if you need to leave to prepare for the floor session shortly and do what you need to do, but I'm going to be here to make sure that everybody has a chance to testify and that we hear House Bill 3049 as well, because I'm anticipating a call of the House that will bring me back up there. So there we go. Thank you for indulging me. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David Beers. I am testifying today in my capacity as president of the Oregon State Association of Self-Help for Hard of Hearing People in support of House Bill 3230. I am currently a member, as was Bob, of the Advisory Committee of the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Access Program, known as DHAP, and have served on this committee with the exception of about 3 years since its very beginning. DHAP has been under the Oregon Disabilities Commission for a number of years. It has become apparent to many of us that DHAP and ODC are no longer a good fit for each other. Some of the reasons for this are the ODC has made it apparent that it does not always value the input it is receiving from the DHAP Advisory Committee, its representatives. This is being perceived by the deaf and hard of hearing people as insulting at the very least. ODC has also put many controls upon the DHAP manager, and she is being required to do the functions for ODC that take away from her time and energy for DHAP. And this has been going on for many years. ODC has been using funds from DHAP to run ODC business, with a resulting drop in manpower to DHAP and its ability to do its functions. DHAP has gone from a staff of about five people with locations in three different areas to a staff of two people or less sharing an office with ODC. Aside from the strained relationship between the DHAP Advisory Committee and ODC, the worst part is that deaf and hard of hearing Oregonians are not receiving the services to which they are entitled. Please support this important legislation. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, David, very much. Appreciate you being here. Robert Pope, is Robert wanting to testify? Well, it says four here.
No, he's
well, I'm going to ask him. Thank you. Would you like to testify or no?
I'd like to apologize. Do you want me to talk or sign? I have your statement. I have no paper with me.
Okay. Well, if you have something you'd like to say, let us know, and if you don't, that's okay.
I'm here as a warm body, that's it.
Okay. I'm here as a warm body.
Do you support this bill?
Advisory, and I'm with ODC Commission, so I can't.
I'm on the advisory, but also with ODC, a commissioner,
so, you're listening.
So I'm sorry.
So you're listening to today's testimony.
I'm a warm body here.
I'm a warm body here.
Thank you for being here. Thank you very much. Is Helen Boyd here? Helen Boyd, welcome.
He's a warm body.
I saw that. I heard that. So I know. I am a lucky person.
Thank you.
Sometimes I'm warm. Sometimes I'm mean.
Sometimes you're mean. Oh, no.
Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you. I'd like to speak to you, Mr. Chairman Dalton, and the members of the committee. I apologize in that my printer was down, so I was unable to do up something to bring to you, among other duties I had to do. So as a gift to you, I brought survivor's manuals that have been compiled by the Hard of Hearing and people in the self-help group in Eugene. Okay, and I am Helen Boyd, as you said, from Eugene, Oregon. I'm an advocate for hard of hearing and deaf people, and I am a 25-year member of the self-help group. And I advocate and do what I can all along the way from day to day. I have a cochlear implant. I've suffered hearing or communication loss. Get this, communication loss for most all of my life, from the time I was at least 10 years old to now, which I'm 75. Okay, so I have lots of experience, and I choose to write a book on this sometime if, God willing, I live long enough. But it's a very isolating, painful, frustrating experience, and I can tell you about some of that. We need to tell you that Helen Keller said that deafness is worse than blindness, in that blindness separates you from things, but deafness from people, and that's certainly the truth. So it's been a very painful thing being separated from people so much throughout my life, and I'm making up for that as best I can now with a cochlear implant. I wore hearing aids all those years and did everything I could to help myself. My family, my mother was deaf, and there was a lot of strife in my family. My father, who would pound on the floor to get her attention, all that kind of stuff, which was a start. But it was so challenging and everything that I believe it led to his suicide when I was about 15 years old. And there was so much strife and everything, you know. And there was a genetic thing passed on to 7 of my brothers and sisters out of 9 people. And we all became from hard of hearing to profoundly deaf by the time we were about 30 years old. And in that group of brothers and sisters, including myself, 5 of us of the 9 were divorced. And this is because of communication loss a great deal. I can tell you that I was married to a spouse who was hard of hearing also, but yet in denial. And denial is more than a really river in Egypt, incidentally. Where could we turn for help? There has been only mostly VRD, the vocational rehab, people or hearing aids. There's some help, of course. Back in the 50s, I was having to deal with an alcoholic husband and 2 children and profound deafness. And the doctor gave me some advice. He says to go to sign myself in the state hospital, which I did for 1 month. They gave me shock treatment. I hardly knew my kids after that. And that was not any real help for me, except it scared me enough I turned away from some of my sins, okay? Really and truly, that's the fact, folks.
But, so, Helen, if I could ask you to wrap things up, we support this bill?
Why do I support this bill? Because we paid taxes all these years. We want equal access to the inaccessible services. Hard of hearing have unique needs that are not being met, and both of us need advocacy with community support. You can make a tremendous difference in our lives, open the job market up, help to educate the public, get rid of some of this now big time discrimination that's being leveled at us every day, single day, every single time we meet people. The doctors and counselors and everybody need to be aware of what is going on in this epidemic, this hearing loss business is. And so people need to be able to go someplace to get information to help steer them in the right direction. And these things are not readily available just through our non-profit, although we've done a tremendous amount of work of advocacy and education and everything. That is, 25 years ago, I had to make a choice between trying to, as a deaf person, with little telephone access, practically none, to work toward a chapter of self-help for hard of hearing people incorporated or a service center. And I couldn't do both. I did what I could, and we have made some great progress, but it's been 25 years, folks, of this, and there's still no real services. And like Bob or someone mentioned, there's other states have these services, service centers, but Oregon does not. We just have no place to turn for help except the hearing aid dealers and the VR counselors, basically, because other kind of counselors, they do not understand the difficulties of hearing loss until we educate them. And it's so piecemeal. And, it's just not right. We pay taxes the same as every other people, and we hold jobs. I'm a manager of a rental manager now. I've done a lot of self-educating. I couldn't even get into the college classes and get the proper help, though I knew exactly what I needed in the last 5-10 years. There's still injustice and discrimination there. Big time. And I tried to deal with that, Justice Department wise and everything. They did not do anything. So we need a service center. We appreciate your advocacy very much. So if you'll help us, you can make a tremendous difference in a huge number of people's world, because we're the most numerous and least served of all disabilities. So thank you for listening to me. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you. And thanks very much for the book. Appreciate it.
You're entirely welcome.
Okay. Next, I'd like to invite Linda Diaz forward.
Sure. Can I make a comment
yes.
while Linda's coming forward? I've been involved with a project with OMSI and with other OHSU scientists on a project called Dangerous Decibels, which is dealing with the whole question of hearing loss. Well, we're hearing some issues today of the classically deaf population. We have an upcoming epidemic of people with severe hearing loss because of a variety of things, loud music and a variety of other things. That this is a problem we're going to have to be facing very seriously in the next generation, as more and more of our young people become severely hearing impaired at a very early age. And I've been welcoming hearing this testimony. We're going to hear more and more about it before we're done here.
Thank you, Representative. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Linda Diaz. I live in Eugene, Oregon. I'm the Hard of Hearing and Deaf Coordinator for Lane Independent Living Alliance, and I've been a peer mentor working with hard of hearing people for 7 years, helping them to get services that they need and helping them to help with their employment issues, such as amplified telephones in the workplace. I'm going to shorten this way down. You can read it later. But I wanted to, Representative Greenlick said was absolutely true. This is a disability, the largest disability in the country, and there's going to be more and more people. The things that we do now is going to affect the entire country in the future. I mean, everyone is going to know at least someone who's hard of hearing, or they will be hard of hearing. I support 3230, and I would please bear with me briefly while I share my personal story of hearing loss. By the way, I want to say I was born in Oregon in Corvallis, and I feel very comfortable today. If I'd known everyone was wearing orange and black, I would have worn orange and black. Both of my parents graduated from OSU. I moved back to Oregon in 1985. In 1989, I was diagnosed with otosclerosis, which causes the inner ear bones to freeze. It's often called Beethoven's disease. I had mild moderate loss at the time. I was told I could have a hearing aid or have a stapendectomy surgery. I hope I'm not going too fast. I'm okay. Okay. I was just terrified. I had no sources, nowhere to go. Nobody told me what to do or how to live with a hearing aid. I was a medical secretary and I relied on my hearing, and I was also a musician. My ENT said that surgery was the best choice. That way I wouldn't have to wear a hearing aid at that age. I had the surgery. The surgery was a terrible experience. I was awake for it so I could tell the physician if I could hear them after they put in the Stapes prosthesis. I was awake so I could hear them hammer out my ear bones, vacuum out remains. I won't go further description of this surgery, but this is what I was offered as a hard of hearing person. After the surgery, I was able to hear well, but my balance was affected. I have otosclerosis in the other ear, but I refuse surgery in that ear. I wear a hearing aid in that ear, and it's worked just fine. In 1996, I was riding a horse. I fell off my horse. I started to have severe vertigo attacks. As it turned out, I felt that there was a pin sticking in my ear. What they do is they put a prosthesis in your ear. When they take out your scapes, they put in a metal prosthesis. What had happened was the pin had broken in half, traveled into my balance center. My husband at the time was a quadriplegic, and I was responsible for driving him. He had a disability. When I explained to him my disability of hearing loss and dizziness, he told me that I was lying and I was lazy, and he divorced me. When I went to court and tried to defend myself with a newfound disability of vertigo, which was hard to explain at the time, I can explain it well now. I couldn't then. It's like if you get on a swing, and when you were a kid and you twirl around on a swing and you get off that swing and you get to see everything be dizzy. Well, that's fun for a while, but it's not fun for a lifestyle. So I tried to explain in the court. The court judge awarded a man with a physical disability everything we had. I was put into poverty. I was told to get an ear operation and get a job. I continued to get worse. The pin was in my ear. I went to another doctor, otolaryngologist. He did a CAT scan. There was a pin sticking 3 centimeters in my ear. I lived with that for two years. My point in telling you this story is to demonstrate the seriousness of hearing loss. If there had been a deaf and hard of hearing center at the time, they could have helped me with my fears of losing my hearing at a young age. They could have offered me more choices. They could have explained to me what wearing a hearing aid is about. I've had surgeries to be able to hear. I've lived with those consequences of the surgery. Permanent damage has been done to my balance center in an attempt to improve my hearing. I have moderate loss in both ears. I wear 2 hearing aids. Even though I had surgery, I still wear 2 hearing aids. I understand my hearing loss is progressive. I have difficulty learning sign language because hand movements make me dizzy. A small group of people in Eugene have started a sign language class that goes really slow for people like me. Our ears, I want to finish by saying our ears affect our daily needs on so many levels. I work with people who are in different states of disability, Lane Independent Living Alliance, and when I come up with my needs, they always say our needs are similar, we all have similar needs, but we really don't. My needs are communicative. Sometimes I'll go to meetings where I'm at, for instance, at a university setting where I'm so-called the only hard of hearing person, the token hard of hearing person. They've asked me to come, but they get upset if I ask to use my FM device to hear you because it slows down the meeting. And these are professors of disability telling me I'm slowing down the meeting. They're often shocked that I ask for closed captioning on films they offer to disabled communities. Sometimes they'll say, oh, let's not get a sign language interpreter. The deaf never show up. So As an advocate, I've got to say to you, this is a huge problem. Our needs are not being met all over the country, and I just really hope that you vote yes for this bill. It's a very important bill.
Okay. Thank you very much, Linda. We appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to invite up Melita Green, Mark Azur, and Renwick Dayton. You can all come up together. I'd appreciate it. All right. Good morning. Welcome. We'll start with Melita.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing my testimony. I am in support of this House bill. My name is Melita Green, and I am speaking as a private individual today. However, my experience is gained from working as an employee of vocational rehabilitation. I am off of the clock right now, and so I am testifying on my own time. I've worked in this field. I've worked with a specialized caseload. I've worked with the deaf and hard of hearing and late deafened for 15 years as a vocational rehabilitation counselor in Eugene. This is about the same period of time that the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Access Program has been established under Oregon Disability Commission. I have seen the DHAP. program be reduced to almost nothing. And the services are not being provided, access is not being provided to the deaf and hard of hearing community. Being in DHS and knowing that we and other sister agencies have a contract to have access provided to our clients, I see that it is not happening. It happens on my caseload because I am educated and because I serve this population. However, on a general caseload or in my agency or on a caseload of like services to people with self-sufficiency program or people with disabilities, the education of our own staff within our departments it's not there to knowing how to provide access for people. The trainers that the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Access Program had at one time going out to train the staff for agencies is not there anymore. So when a deaf or hard of hearing person comes and asks for access, oftentimes the staff person doesn't know what to do. You know, I believe the current where the HAP is situated now in ODC gives them low authority, which means low communication access. They do not have their own voice. A deaf or hard of hearing person is not. The director of that program advocating for themselves, they do not have the experience of that person, maybe a hearing person, that person may be a person with another disability, but they are not a person with a deaf or hard of hearing disability who can speak from personal knowledge about the limitations that this disability imposes. Secondly, there is a low level of service for deaf and hard of hearing people, which results in a low communication access. I have already mentioned this in terms of training our agency staff to provide information, also training the consumers. The deaf and hard of hearing people who are here are those who are involved in organizations for self-help for hard of hearing, for the deaf associations. There are others out there who come to me, vocational rehab, because they want employment. They're not involved with these organizations. They don't have the training to advocate for themselves. These individuals also need to be represented. There's not enough staff. Not enough service centers that provide this kind of training for the consumers themselves.
Okay,
thirdly,
Felita, I need to have you wrap up. So.
Okay, one third point is that there is low advocacy, which means low communication access. People have mentioned here the blind who have had strong advocacy for many years in Oregon have their own commission. Deafness and blindness are both sensory disabilities. They both need to have strong advocacy from their own.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for hearing my testimony.
Sure. Good morning. Welcome.
I won't be using the microphone. Thanks anyway. Hello, my name is Mark Azure. I will emphasize that it's a female interpreter. I'm not a male. I am signing. That's why you hear a female's voice. She's the interpreter. Okay. I worked formerly for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing program. I was an agency trainer. I had that role for 7 years. And I want to extend a thank you to Oregon Disability Commission for their tremendous support. They gave me the opportunity to go and provide these trainings on ADA. And it was very beneficial for the state of Oregon and for the deaf community. I trained the senators as well. Many people... there are many, many people to thank. I've gotten many letters of thanks from people for Hyatt providing that training. The deaf and hard of hearing very much appreciate that training being done to emphasize education in their work environments, and it has been very important. And we need this bill to pass to provide that. I've been teaching a deaf studies class, and I have taught at the interpreting program and the sign language program as well at PCC for 25 years. I've seen a lot of attempts made to bridge some of the gaps. Here in the state, I worked very hard on bridging some of these gaps, and I see now that some of those bridges are beginning to falter and collapse. And please, do not allow that to happen. Please keep this bill alive. It's going to be very important. Often when I traveled to deaf events, very often people would approach me. They wanted to know information about the ADA, Titles 1 and 2, and I've been very willing as a volunteer to give my time to explain, encourage them to check the websites and that sort of thing, and provide this so that they could educate the people in their state offices. But that was voluntary. What a pain in the neck. There was no smooth process to keep providing this, so we do need to continue to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Honorable Representative Bill Dalto, Chairman, and other members of the committee. My name is Renwick Dayton, and I'm from Hillsboro, Oregon. I've been deaf since I was 6 months old. I've been a taxpayer since 1955. And also a registered voter. I'm representing Oregon Association of the Deaf in my second term of presidency. OAD is an affiliated member of the National Association of the Deaf. It's a blessing that NAD has been a watchdog and fighting for our civil rights and for strengthening our advocacy in Washington, D.C., as well as in the states. 425 years. OAD is doing the same thing in Oregon since 1921. I give my commendation to deaf and hard of hearing Oregonians for their 3 years of very hard effort to have these two bills brought to the floor this year. The one we will testify today is for House Bill 3230. And I agree, it's very important to have this bill passed right now. Here's the reason. For about 18 years, the existing Deaf and Hard of Hearing Access Program, DHAP, has been under the control of the Oregon Disabilities Commission. They have failed our people because they do not provide them any external services. DHAP provides only internal services to the state agencies. This is a very serious matter, because ODC and Deaf and Hard of Hearing Access Program are already being tarnished in the perception of the deaf and hard of hearing communities. This is why the bill, House Bill 3230, needs to be passed, and the name, Deaf and Hard of Hearing Access Program, needs to be changed. We recommend to the Office for Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services and transfer. As stated in House Bill 3230, is a must. This will improve its image and approachability for our people. Deaf and hard of hearing Oregonians' goal for the Oregon Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services is to be a self-governing body, self-determined administration, self-determined budget, would include as well a board for advisory committee with 52% deaf and hard of hearing members, and also authorized to interview and hire a director or program manager for the ODHHS and the staff, and also to review and approve RFP to contract out to implement the service centers. Fourth, it would be to encourage ODHHS to catch up to what the other states already provide. Number five, no more oppression, no more autism. We are tired of being controlled, and we are really fed up being oppressed for hundreds of years. For your information, Alexander Graham Bell was the one who influenced a ban on the famed Martha's Vineyard sign language culture. Number six, we would suggest placing ODHHS under the proper department that would allow ODHHS to administer independently because they know deaf and hard of hearing needs and understand their culture better than any other state of Oregon agencies. Deaf and hard of hearing Oregonians desire the state of Oregon legislators to give an opportunity with trust that ODHHS is capable to administer its office. May I persuade you to support by vote of aye on House Bill 3230. Thank you very much, Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify today. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Mr. Dayton. Thank you very much. And please don't take any offense that I'm the only one left standing here. Everybody else is on the House floor right now where they're in session. And may I invite you at the conclusion of this hearing to come and visit the floor session in the House so that you can observe what's going on. There's a very interesting bill up today on taxation that you might care to see. So thank you. Is there a Sherry Andrews here? Andrews. Oh, that's Sherry. And then is there a Jeannie Ott Mendiola?
Yes.
Yes, ma'am?
I'm right now speaking for myself. I didn't get George's testimony.
Okay.
Okay. Yes.
Well, there are no interpreters provided on the floor today, Representative Belto. So that is a perfect example of some of the reasons we're here.
Okay. Yes, that's a good point. Thank you very much. Okay, Sherry, go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Dalto and members of the committee, my name is Sherry Andrus, and I'm a sign language interpreter in Oregon for over 20 years, and I'm also a member of the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Access Program, their advisory committee. I'm here today to ask you to support House Bill 3230. We've all heard the statement, if it's not broke, don't fix it. But we also know that when something is broken, we need to analyze the situation and bring in experts to figure out the solution needed to fix the problem. Both professional and personal members of the deaf and hard of hearing community are presenting to you today that House Bill 3230 is the solution to a problem that's been affecting Oregon for many years. I was going to tell you a little bit of the history, but you've already heard that our program is now down to one person, and it's seriously affecting the contracts we have with state agencies. The marriage between the Oregon Disability Commission and the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Access Program doesn't work. The agendas of the two programs are inconsistent with each other. There is a long history of tension between the two programs, and separation of them would allow them both to pursue the missions they were charged to do. Chair Dalto, suppose I were to tell you that a program was going to be set up to support the needs of men. However, it would be a woman that's going to be running this program and deciding what your needs are. I promise you that what women think men need and what men think they need are probably two very different things. Maybe women would think that men need more lessons in cleaning house, and I bet that men probably would disagree with that.
Actually, I'm told I need to eat more vegetables.
Or that, too. But my point is that for many years, deaf and hard of hearing have had others tell them what their needs are. House Bill 3230 would change that and allow the deaf and hard of hearing the ability to make the appropriate choices for over 300,000 deaf and hard of hearing Oregonians. I like what Representative Butler said about learning from other states, because I agree in that philosophy as well. 34 other states have already recognized the importance of allowing deaf and hard of hearing people the ability to make the proper choices for their states as it relates to these two communities, and have set up commissions or offices to do such that. In addition, most of those states have also realized the appropriate placement of such an office is under their Department of Human Services or as independent agencies directly under the governor. I will be giving the committee administrator a survey that's done annually that shows the statistics of what other states are doing, and I think Representative Butler would really enjoy looking at that as well. It is an annual survey that is done for all of the independent state agencies that serve the deaf and hard of hearing, and I would be really, really proud if Oregon could be part of that survey next year and become the 35th state that recognizes the terms deaf and dumb are far from true and won't be tolerated in this state. In closing, I know that it's impossible for you to be experts on all of the issues that come before you during a legislative session. I ask you to recognize that the experts in this issue are sitting in this room today, and they're the members of the deaf and hard of hearing community, the people who will be most affected by this bill. Listen to their stories and support their solution, which is House Bill 3230. Thank you, and I am be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. Jeannie.
Honorable Chair Dalto and members of the committee, my name is Jeannie Ott Mendiola, and I live in Sandy, Oregon. I'm a member of the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Access Program Advisory Committee. And the Alliance for Deaf and Hard of Hearing. Since early childhood, I had a progressive hearing loss, which was diagnosed at the age of 6. I'm a native of Washington State and currently work as an equal opportunity employer specialist for the Mount Hood National Forest in Sandy. I've been involved with the deaf community in a number of states as an advocate for over 30 years. I'm here to ask for your support and a do-pass vote for House Bill 3230. As a deaf professional who's lived in a number of states, like Georgia, California, Washington, Virginia, Wisconsin, those states have a commission office for the deaf and hard of hearing services, and I'm very used to living in states that have services. When my family moved here to Oregon in the fall of 2001, I asked around, where's the deaf service office? And I was told, well, we have the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Access Program. And so I asked around, and I found out later that they serve the state agencies only. I thought that was very odd. They don't serve the community? And something's wrong here. It did not make sense to me, and I didn't like it, but such is the state. I moved here, I work here, and I don't have a choice. I can't just pick up and move. It seems to me that having to high up under the ODC doesn't make a lot of sense. Because for one thing, the funding that's been used hasn't been appropriate. We have a college, Gallaudet University, and it's appropriate for deaf in their studies for higher education. Many colleges focus on deaf programs, but do we have any college that focuses on disabilities only? You won't see that. How many people know sign language? How many people understand how to use sign language or real-time captioning or the relay calls in system? How many people really understand how to communicate with deaf and hard of hearing people? Not very many people do, and that's very unfortunate, and it needs to be changed. The Deaf and Hard of Hearing Access Program will be able to function more effectively and to expand instead of serving only the state agencies, to serve statewide people who are deaf and hard of hearing and really need the services. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, we appreciate you being here and educating us in Oregon about how far we need to come in providing these services. Thank you so much. We're grateful to have you. Okay. Well, I think that covers everybody who's signed up to testify. Did we miss anybody? Okay, no. Well, with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3230. I want to thank you all very much for being here and appreciate your input and testimony. And we will get your comments to the members of the committee that had to leave for the floor session. There's one more bill that I'd like to hear, and then I have to go up and do my job upstairs.
So we will open the public hearing on House Bill 3049 and ask Brian DeLashman to introduce it briefly to us, and then we'll call up Cindy and Caleb after that.
Mr. Chair, I'll spend a minute or less. For the record, I'm Brian DeLashman. I'm the lobbyist for the Community Providers Association of Oregon.
Brian, hang on just one second.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Again, for the record, my name is Brian DeLashman. I'm the lobbyist for the Community Providers Association of Oregon. I know you're familiar with this issue, but just let me tee it up in about 30 seconds. The reason why this bill was introduced, and Norm Kohler, who was with me and will come back at a later time, actually raised this issue for me, is that they believe at the level, DD and MED, residential level, that there is a disincentive for their residents to actually participate in work programs and earn some kind of a living. They tell of issues where, because of the combination of earned and unearned income, that the state captures all of the money, the earned income money, and that in many cases the residential providers as a group have to hold fundraisers or collect dollars to help pay for some essential services or essential products like toothpaste, toothbrushes, shoes, socks, and underwear. And what they'd like to see is removing a disincentive, or at least a partial removal of a disincentive for these people to have some earned income. Thank you.
We're gonna do some more work on this. I'd like to get this bill passed, and we'll get the comments that the public is going to make on this bill over to the rest of the committee so that they are familiarized, and we'll bring it back up when they're available too. Caleb and Cindy, come on forward, please. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. I'm Caleb Arnold, and I'm an advocate. At this point, I'm kind of with SAL, which is Self Advocacy Leaders. I am the chairperson of the quality team of Integrated Services Network, and we work to make sure that all of our customers that are within our brokerage get quality services, which I think is most definitely put forth in Bill 3049, because I believe, and I work for Goodwill as an employee, and I am also under that statute that I don't get very much for what I do. We work under a statute called piece rate, which is basically, to kind of describe it to you, is let's say you work doing books, maybe 100 books an hour, and you get $1. Okay? And then let's say you wanted to take your girlfriend or boyfriend out for an evening on the town, and you only have 15 to 20 bucks to take he or her out to dinner, and which is not a whole lot.
Choices are limited.
Very limited. And I believe that if you support what we're talking about here, that we can make a change.
Okay. Thanks, Caleb. And Cindy, welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having us here, Chair. My name is Cindy Hellington, and I'm the executive director for South Advocates Leaders, and I'm one of the representatives for the DD Coalition. And I'm here to say the DD Coalition is supporting this, and it's HB 3049, and it's a terrible truth that people with developmental disabilities cannot keep their income that they work for to be able to do what they need to do. But they respect people like I just met him.
Well, he's a good guy. Caleb and I go back a little while.
Yeah. Like, he does have, fixed income, and I think he respects the, you know, the people who pay for their services, but taking all their money, that's not right.
No.
And you have my testimony here, there. And I really thank you guys, and I know you guys need to be upstairs pretty soon, and I really thank you for being here, testify here.
Well, Cindy, I really appreciate you being here and for sticking it out through this long hearing this morning. I have your comments here, and we're going to do the best we can to try to make sure that you can keep more of the money that you earn, that you rightfully earn.
I'm advocating for other people.
For your clients, okay. Thank you.
Not clients, other advocates that couldn't be here.
Okay. Well, we appreciate you sharing your voice on their behalf.
I would like to add something else that I forgot. You know, when I was saying about the money, you know, you get a certain amount when you work for it, but see, when you have a limited amount of money that you work for, then you have to delve into your own budget from whether it's SSI or side jobs that you have to make up for that difference.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I really encourage you to support us on this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much, Caleb. Is Sue Neal present? And Sally Mills? Excellent. And those are the last two folks signed up. And I can go back to work. I hope so. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Glad you could be here.
Okay, you want to talk a little bit? And try and sign, and I'll read for you.
Yeah.
Go ahead and say something.
Her name? Junelle.
Good afternoon. Good morning. What's your name?
Sue Neal.
Okay, welcome.
Hey. My name is Sue Neal. I am 37 years old. I live in West Salem duplex with my roommate and my pet cat, Peaches. I enjoy a lot of activities and interests. Basketball, arts and crafts, swimming, collecting movies, and going to the movies, among many other things. That is when I'm not at my job at Goodwill. I work there Monday through Friday, 1 to 5. I really value my job. I have staff and friends I really like there. I especially like my paycheck. It helps me enjoy the activities I mentioned. I would like to be able to save for a vacation. I really work hard for the money I earn. I would like to keep as much of it as possible. It would really make it hard for me to have to pay even more in room and board and offset than I do now. I'm here to ask you to help me have a good quality life and be able to still enjoy all that is important to me and that makes my life happy.
Sue, where do you want to go on vacation?
Disneyland.
Disneyland. All right. Excellent. Well, thank you for being here today. This is like my Disneyland. Okay. I appreciate you being here. Thank you.
Okay. And I'm here supporting Sue, but I also am the Director of Employment Services at Partnerships in Community Living. And I've worked for 25 years under the belief that all people need to work and contribute to their communities. I've assisted people with developmental disabilities find jobs and become successful members of their community. They earn money and thus are able to spend it and contribute to the economic health of both their community and to Oregon. It is my belief that work is one of the great equalizers of all people. All people need to work and contribute. It's what it makes us all feel useful and worthwhile. However, their earnings should be the rewards for a job well done and not as a way to offset costs. For many people, much of what they earn is used as an offset for the cost of their services. And I have included four pictures. But David earns $139 and he pays an offset of $43, which only allows him $96 a month. Ted makes $441, pays $423. It allows him only $18 a month. Sue has made $240 and pays an offset of $238, allowing her $2, which doesn't go very far towards a vacation. Buddy makes $136, and he also pays an offset of $134. This bill, we want this bill not to take away the incentive to work, and it's a very important piece of what our lives are. And would we work if we had saw almost nothing out of our earnings? It's not fair to David, Ted, Sue, or Buddy, or for many others like them. Please help equalize it.
Yeah, we've got to fix this.
Yeah.
And that's why we put it up. So we're going to get to work on it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sally. Thank you, Sue.
Yep.
With that, we are going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3049, and we're going to adjourn our meeting.